The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Super Bowl 51, or Super Bowl LI if you're not up on your Roman numerals, is just a couple weeks away. Another epic matchup, another anticipated halftime performance, and another batch of the costliest ads in television history. Something is amiss on that last point. Those high-profile commercial spots are not selling the way they used to. Tim Calkins is clinical professor of marketing at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. He wrote about why Super Bowl ads are a tough sell in 2017 for Fortune. And Tim, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
So how far behind are Super Bowl ads this year, and how do you track them?
Well, the network releases information about Super Bowl ad sales, and it's always a little bit hard to figure out precisely how they're tracking. But this year is, you know, different because usually by this point, the network that's hosting the Super Bowl this year, it's Fox, would have said the game is sold out or would have said we're down to just two or three spots left. But that hasn't happened this year. And so even now with the game now just, you know, a couple weeks away, apparently there are still quite a few spots available on the Super Bowl. That's fairly unique from what we've seen over the past several years.
What is your top reason they're not selling as well as they used to?
One is there certainly is the cost issue. And of course, that's always been the case. But more and more, the price of a Super Bowl ad keeps going up. So This year, they're saying now it's somewhere between $5 and $5.5 million for a 30-second spot. But that's just the beginning, because even once you pay for that, you've then got to produce an ad, which could be another $1 million by the time you're done. And then you need a PR campaign and a social media campaign. And the expense is really very high. But the other thing that's different, I think, now is that advertisers are a little worried about all of the attention that comes from going on the Super Bowl. The stakes are high. Now, that helps you, but it can also become a problem if the ad doesn't land properly. And so you can offend people, and you can actually do some damage to your brand if you're not careful.
So you said $5 to $5.5 million for a 30-second spot. Now, that is compared to what?
Well, last year, the comparable figure would be sort of $4.8 to $5 million. And then, you know, if you go back to 2012, so you go back just 5 years, it was you know, the range of $3.5 million. So in just 5 years, it's gone up, you know, a huge amount.
Big jump. You think they'll come down in price if they don't sell?
Oh, I think there's no question that, you know, right now the network is working very hard to fill up those last spots. And I think they're going to negotiate off that price, you know, quite a lot. You know, so if you're in the market for a Super Bowl ad, it's not a bad time to go try to negotiate for one, because you can probably get a discount. Because see, the Super Bowl, you know, it's like an airline ticket. Once the game happens, then it's done. And if the network has not filled all of those spots, then it's it's a challenge.
Well, an airline ticket gets you one place to another in a pretty sure way. But now with social media, when you can actually make a difference, you can have a campaign that goes viral without spending all of that money, why would the cost of a Super Bowl ad be going up?
Well, what's happening is that the media world is changing fairly dramatically for advertisers. And the big thing that's happening is all of the traditional platforms that marketers used to be able to count on. So call that, you know, your network television and, you know, radio and print, and all of these things are fragmenting down. And as a result, marketers are left now relying on social, relying on shares and all of these different platforms. The problem is those are very hard to work with. They can be expensive, but they're also very unpredictable. The Super Bowl is so unique in this way because the Super Bowl still attracts a huge number of people. So on the Super Bowl, you'll have roughly 110 million people watching the game. And that's an extraordinary opportunity in the world these days, and it is more and more unique. That's why some of the advertisers, you know, we'll still see a full collection of advertisers by the time we're done, and they'll still invest the money because there aren't many other ways to reach that many people that quickly.
So costs, risk of damaging your brand, no surprise those would favor into a decision not to buy a Super Bowl ad or to do it. But you also suspect politics is a factor. How so?
You know, politics, I think, certainly plays a role in all of this. And I think it's in two different ways. So one, I think we're seeing marketers think about how do they want to allocate their budgets and do they want to spend right now given, even though there's optimism, but there's also uncertainty in the road ahead. The other place we'll see it, I think, is in the content of Super Bowl ads. One of the things to watch for this year is to what degree does advertisers refer to, reflect, touch at all on any of the divisions, the conflict currently going on in the country. Now, we know that there won't be anything too overtly political, right? So already one advertiser has been rejected because they had a piece of advertising that featured a wall. And, you know, Fox said, boy, we're not going to run that. But, you know, you see the tonality come through in lots of different ways. We don't know what people are going to run on the Super Bowl yet, and it's going to be really interesting to watch how do they navigate that because it's a difficult time right now for the country.
You study marketing. So do you look at the Super Bowl as an indicator for trends in advertising, or is it a completely different beast operating by a totally different set of rules?
Well, it's all different because there's nothing like the Super Bowl. But I think you can certainly see a lot of trends in the Super Bowl. So on the one hand, you can see, I think, all of the latest approaches to marketing that are out there. And the reason is because everybody brings their best innovations and their best material to the Super Bowl because it's just that important. The other thing is I think you really can see a bit of a reflection of the country when you look at Super Bowl ads. All of these marketers spend an incredible amount of money to understand how people are feeling, to develop ads that will resonate and connect and stand out. And so to some degree, you can really see a reflection of the country and what they decide is going to really work and stand out this year. That's going to make it a really interesting Super Bowl. I mean, the football should be interesting, but the advertising will be particularly interesting to really see what is the country's mood and how do we see that play out in these ads.
Tim Calkins, he's clinical professor of marketing at Northwestern University. Tim, thank you for speaking with us.
Well, thank you.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Someone once told me time is a flat circle. Everything we've ever done or will do, we're going to do over and over and over again.
That's Matthew McConaughey from the first season of the HBO series True Detective, describing one view of the nature of time. Time can also be said to be on our side. It can fly as fast as it can drag along. Time is money, shouldn't be wasted unless you enjoy it, and then it's not considered wasted time. It can heal all wounds, change all things. Tennessee Williams called it the longest distance between two places, and Einstein said time is an illusion. There is not enough time for me to describe all the ways that time can be perceived, but we're going to do our best to unravel a bit of the mystery and obsession that we have with time. With Alan Burdick. He's a staff writer and former senior editor at The New Yorker. He's got a new book out called Why Time Flies, a mostly scientific investigation. And Alan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So you mentioned early in the book that time is the most commonly used noun in American English. Why are we so obsessed with time?
That's a great question. I mean, I think time is the great, it's the great equalizer, right? It's the one thing that we certainly all have in common and that we cannot escape, so we are always complaining about it.
What is time is such a simple three-word question, and you spent a decade on this book anyway looking for an answer. Why is it so hard to define?
Well, you know, I started out thinking this might be kind of a straightforward project. I don't know why now I thought that. But I started out, you know, asking different psychologists and neuroscientists, what is time? not space time, but you know, this thing in us that we all feel and that shapes our experience. And they all responded, "Well, what do you mean by time?" And so I quickly understood that I had a lot to tackle. And you know, the fact is, time really is a lot of things. Time is, of course, you know, what time it is right now, but it's also our understanding that before is not the same as after, and that the past is not the same as the future, and that things happen in order in time, in temporal order, and we have some sense that, you know, of now, and that time is passing somehow. And these are all actually fairly distinct experiences that come online in humans at different ages. You know, we weren't all born with this stuff. We learn most of it.
I'm going to hop on you saying time is in us, because that's part of the question you're asking here. Where is time? Is it in our brains? Is it in our bodies or consciousness? What did you find out about how time is embedded within our bodies?
Well, it's really everywhere, and we are manifestations of it. And what I mean is, so we're born with a certain kind of time called circadian time. So in each of our cells, in all of our cells, we have basically a clock that's driven by the genetics within the nucleus of the cell. And that clock ticks out a very regular 24-hour rhythm, circadian rhythm. So things like your body temperature follow a very strict 24-hour cycle. It's lowest early in the morning, before you wake up, and it's at its peak in the middle of the day. Your threshold for pain is actually highest in the late morning, so that makes it a great time to, you know, go to the dentist. and hair grows more slowly at night than it does during the day. So that's why men have 5 o'clock in the afternoon shadow, but they don't wake up with 5 o'clock in the morning shadow. So these, you know, these circadian rhythms, these 24-hour rhythms, run a lot of our physiology. But there are other experiences of time too, like sitting at a stoplight. You know, you sit at the same stoplight, and one day it seems to last a little longer. It's like you've been timing it without noticing it, and so you have a sense of what that duration should be. Now, where exactly that experience arises in your brain is still a pretty hot topic among neuroscientists, but you know, it turns out that we humans aren't the only ones who do that. You know, you can train a dog or a rat to expect food every 10 minutes or 30 minutes, and that's because somewhere in its brain it has some kind of a time or a timer that can learn and remember intervals of time.
Well, this sitting at a stoplight, this is one of the realities of contemporary life. Sleep deprivation is as well for a lot of people. Anxiety is. Transcontinental travel. How do these aspects of the way we live now conflict with that internal 24-hour clock, those circadian rhythms?
Yeah, so, you know, our cells, our organs, all have these circadian clocks in them, and they really depend on being able to talk to each other and stay in sync with each other. You know, if you eat at a certain time, your liver knows to be active at a certain time of day, and your, you know, adrenal glands know to be active at certain times of day and less active at other times of day. And, you know, most of the time, that works with the day-night cycle. But, you know, if you travel, and you shift time zones, an hour, 3 hours, 5 hours, it takes your body a while to catch up. It takes about a day for your body to get in sync again for every time zone that you travel. And the result is, you know, you can come to a new place and eat, your digestive system just isn't really now ready to digest at that time of day, and that can give you gastrointestinal stress. People who work on night shifts really do a number on their bodies. There have been a lot of studies indicating that people who who work long periods on night shifts suffer from things like diabetes and other metabolic diseases at much higher rates than other people. And that's because they are living or trying to live on a 24-hour cycle that just does not match the 24 hours that's hardwired into their cells.
I'm speaking with Alan Burdick about his new book, Why Time Flies, a Mostly Scientific Investigation. We have this perception of time that many people say time feels like it's moving faster as we get older. Also the perception that time moves more quickly when we're enjoying ourselves. What did you find about these common perceptions, no matter what our age and what we're actually doing?
Yeah, I found that, studies really do indicate that time does slow down when you're bored or, you know, at a dull dinner party, and it does speed up when you are having fun. Well, it feels like it is. It's going to sound a little circular, but the reason that time slows down when you're dull, when you're bored, is because basically you're looking at your watch. You're paying attention to the time. That's almost the definition of boredom. And so you're at a dinner party or you're at a movie and you're looking at your watch and you think, oh, how much longer, you know? And your experience afterwards is of a movie or a dinner party where you were thinking about your watch the whole time. So time takes up more of your memory, the thinking about time, and so that time seems to last longer. You know, when you go to a movie that you're really enjoying and you're not thinking about the time, and you come out and you're like, oh, my gosh, 2 hours just went by. So what that boils down to is time can slow down in the present, but time doesn't speed up in the present. You're never anywhere thinking, wow, time is flying by right now. Time flies by after you've had fun. It's never really flying by consciously while you are having fun.
I'm thinking of so many things that come across in this book. Now exists only later. As you said, you know, a good time only exists later, or what is the present? And these are all things that probably could be on, you know, one of those signs that the bearded guy is carrying in a less funny New Yorker cartoon.
Yeah.
But how about you? I mean, historically, you've had a terrible relationship with time. How did writing this book help you understand time differently without climbing up to the mountaintop and speaking to that guru?
Well, you know, partly through, you know, reading about circadian rhythms and realizing that, first of all of my cells are clocks and that put together they form a clock. You know, I am a clock. I am a walking clock, as are you. And in order for the two of us to interact and be social, we need to synchronize our clocks, not just the clocks on our watches, but the clocks of ourselves, you know. So time is, it's not just something that I put on my wrist, which is how I thought about it for the longest time, but it's just integral to me and to us. You know, if you and I were sitting in the same room and you saw me smile, the difference between a real smile and a fake smile is a matter of milliseconds. And for you to perceive that, you need to have a really finely tuned sense of timing. and so having that timing, that awareness of timing, you know, makes our socializing happen or not happen, or happen better or happen less well. And so, I just began to realize that time is very much a social process. You know, it's not just something imposed by the universe, but it's a thing that we create among ourselves, almost like a language.
Well, thank you for speaking about that language with us today, Alan.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Alan Burdick, he's a staff writer at The New Yorker, frequent contributor to Elements, that's the magazine science and tech blog, and his new book is called Why Time Flies, a Mostly Scientific Investigation.
This is Catelyn Moran with the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. Is that the official voice?
I'm doing it in my official voiceover voice, yes.
And I'm Virginia Prescott with my regular old hosty voice. Catlin Moran is the best-selling author of How to Be a Woman and More Anthology, and she's columnist for The Times of London. She and her sister developed and write Raised by Wolves. That's a British TV series loosely based on their experience in a family of 10 growing up in a tiny subsidized flat in the English Midlands. She is also a wife, a mother of two, and an unapologetic feminist. And she's really, really funny. Catlin Moran is now out with Moranifesto. It's her second collection of columns and essays. The Harvard Bookstore sponsored her event to talk about the book at the Brattle Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Sarah Plourd and I caught up with her before she went on stage. We found her warm, playful, and not at all anxious about going on stage or about writing.
I have to say, I find all writing really easy. It's never been a problem. It's where I'm happiest. I feel physically joyful in front of a keyboard. I get a kind of tingling in my fingers and in my breast area. Sometimes my mouth waters as if I'm about to eat something delicious. It's literally my happy place. So I'd love to be able to tell you an agonized story about how difficult it is to be an artist, but it's actually really easy.
I wondered about that because you do write so much, and I thought maybe it's being on deadline all the time that makes her so prolific.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, I mean, you know, but humans do what they have to do. It's that whole kind of, you know, if you want something done, ask a busy woman. Certainly when I was only writing one column a week when I was 18, it would take me 5 days and I would aggregate those over each column, over each sentence. But now I write 3 columns a week. I'm writing a book. We're writing 2 movies. I write a TV show. And you just get up at 9 o'clock and you have to get it done by 4 because that's when the kids are coming home. It's that simple.
Is that what you do? You have a schedule like every day I'm writing this much?
Yep. Every day. I know exactly what I'm writing every day for the next year and a half. It's very, you know, I have to have that kind of schedule or else the whole thing would just go to hell.
And do you have any kind of rituals around it? Like, you know, I have to sit down in this chair with this cup of tea with la-di-da.
There's this incredibly ancient ritual that was passed down. There's kind of this sort of secret brotherhood of writers. And I was lucky enough to go to one of their drinking clubs once. And they sort of swore me to secrecy about this. And they said that what you must do if you want to write a certain amount of words every day is sit on the chair and don't get up until you've finished. And that has worked really well, but don't tell anyone else that secret. Yes.
It's between us. How do you know when to walk away, though, if it's not flowing?
I mean, it's never not flowed. I mean, I would really like to manufacture some kind of problem here, but like kind of because I know what I have to write all the time, like I just make sure that the day before I'm thinking about what I have to write. So I'm not thinking. I do the thinking the day before. And when I sit down, I'm simply there to transcribe it. And I will smoke 3 cigarettes and I will sit on my posturally correct stool. And then when the kids come home, I'll make their tea. Like kind of, I mean, I've just been doing it for a very long time. If I wasn't this fast and efficient, I would shout at me and go, why have you not learned how to do this yet, woman? I've been doing this a long time. Come on.
How did you form that discipline? It just always happened like that?
Well, I had the useful grounding of absolute pure terror and complete abject poverty. And those two things really will teach you to write quite quickly and quite efficiently. So when I was 13, it was very obvious that my family was going to be poor forever. We were raised on benefits. There were 8 of us. We were homeschooled. And so it became very clear that not only in order to ever be able to have any money and buy myself a pair of shoes, but also to be able to meet another human being and kiss them possibly with tongues, I would have to teach myself a trade, writing, go out there, have some money. And if I had to pay someone to kiss me. It all seemed very obvious.
So for somebody who is a new writer, just beginning, who wants to write books like you or a column or television shows, what do you think is the most common mistake they make?
There was the advice that Alan Corran, the brilliant columnist in the UK, taught his daughter, who's now a brilliant writer, Victoria Corran, which is the first thought you have about something you're going to write, everyone will have had that. And the second thought, quite a lot of clever people will have. But the third thought that you have, that will be yours alone. So whatever your first response is when you're writing something, you know, your first hot take will be everybody's hot take. Your second one, quite a few will have it. Keep thinking until you get to the third one. That's when you start writing. And when, you know, it's difficult to write if you're trying to write the first or the second take because you know that's what everybody else is doing. You're in a very crowded arena. Once you've got that idea that you know no one else has got, that's when it's easy. It's like being on a sports field and having like an open run onto the goal. It's like, this is all mine. No one has said this before. That's why it's easy to write. If you once you've done the thinking and found what no one else is saying, then all you need to do is uncover that truth and say that thing. And then you're just transcribing a truth. You're not having to think anymore.
It's a good little nugget. How about the worst advice about writing you ever heard?
Julie Burchill's a columnist in the UK who I greatly admire, but apparently she opens a bottle. She used to open a bottle of champagne when she started to write her column, and as she finished the bottle of champagne, that was when she knew she had finished her column. If I literally have one drop of alcohol, I cannot write. Kind of as soon as I taste alcohol, I'm like, no, it's party time. My brain will work no more now. So I think drinking, I think getting horrendously drunk whilst drinking is a very bad idea. I mean, when you're younger, if you've got talent, and I think you are born with talent in a writer's brain, what can be really frustrating is that you want to write, but you've got nothing to write because nothing's happened to you yet. So you do need to understand that, and it's a brilliant excuse to have, that, you know, your teenage years and your 20s and maybe your 30s are going to have to be you going out there and having messy experiences so that you gather material to sit down and write in your 40s once you're tired and your knees have gone.
Is there a book or a work that made you want to be a writer?
I was really lucky. One of the things that I realised, particularly if you're a woman writer out there, you know, a girl, and you're kind of, you know, you're wondering why things seem to be quite difficult for you. One of the things that I realised, that being home educated, I wasn't reading the curriculum that you're supposed to read. And had I read the curriculum I was supposed to read, it would have been dominated by male writers. And necessarily most of the female characters that I would be reading would be through the male gaze. And it's a horrible one. When I finally got around to reading Roth and Faulkner and Chandler, I was just like, I don't like these women. I would have felt terrible if those are the women that I'd read about in books. Being self-educated, I just naturally honed in without thinking about it to female writers. So I was brought up on Jane Eyre and Jane Austen, Anne of Green Gables, What Katie Did, and these were all brilliant female role models. So I would say for women, go out there and find, you know, find writers that make you feel good about yourself, that you think, oh, I could write like that. And for me, when I read women, I went, okay, now I know I can write.
Don't you think sometimes when people say, oh, she's a great woman writer, it's code for something else?
Yeah, people won't say that in the future. Like, kind of, it's just going to be one of those things that people won't say. In the same way, when people go, she's a massive bitch, and in the future we'll just be, no, she's the president. Like, kind of, you know, we'll stop saying things like that.
Is there a desert island book that you have in mind?
What would I take with me? I don't think it was a big book over here, but there's a book called The Diary of Adrian Mole, which is about a boy from the Midlands who's 13. It's written by one of our greatest ever comic writers, Sue Townsend, who's fantastic. She herself was working class. I read that first when I was 12. It's about a 13-year-old boy. And at 12, I thought he was this impossibly together, glamorous boy at the age of 13. I read it again at 18 and went, oh my God, he's just this dweeby idiot who's just bumbling along. You read it again at 13, you realise his mother, who's this feminist who's gone off and had an affair, that he's kind of writing as an unreliable narrator, is absolutely incredible. And I think it's just the funniest book ever written by a human. And it's about working class, normal suburban life. And that tends not to be chronicled.
Do you have a fantasy job other than writer?
No. I've got to say, I've looked around and I think this is the best job. I've got a little office at the bottom of my garden now, and I walk down there in the morning with a cup of tea and a pack of cigarettes, and I sit down and I just write until I've made myself laugh or until I feel I've uncovered a thing that needed to be said. And then I lock the door of the shed and go into the house and go and watch Westworld. Life couldn't be any better than that.
Caitlin Moran, thank you so much.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Caitlin Moran is the author of How to Be a Woman, Moranifesto, and other best-selling books. The 10-Minute Writers Workshop podcast is a production of NHPR, produced by Sarah Plourd with help from Maureen McMurray. You can search 10-Minute Writers NHPR wherever you get your podcasts to subscribe. We are out of time, but wanted to let you know about a really interesting speaker coming to New Hampshire this weekend. One of the bright spots of the Oscar-nominated documentary film Food, Inc. was Joel Salatin, a self-declared Christian, libertarian, environmentalist, capitalist, lunatic farmer. The author, fourth-generation farmer, and pioneer of grass-fed farming is the keynote speaker at the Northeast Organic Farming Association of New Hampshire's winter conference this Saturday. Go to nofanh.org for more information, and we'll post a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came from Hurry Up, David Seste, Valella Valella, and Delay. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.